This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Brent Spence Bridge faces an uncertain future. It's closed right now after a devastating crash involving two semis earlier this week. Kentucky's governor says the closure could last weeks or a month. And Ohio's governor says it could be 60 to 90 days. The bridge connects these two states via Interstate 71 and 75, and it carries 3% of the nation's gross domestic product each year. Let's get caught up on this situation. WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner joins us remotely via Zoom. Tana, thank you for taking part of your Friday with us.
I'm excited to be here.
I know you've seen the photo. I've seen the photo. People can see the photo at WVXU.org, the aftermath of this fiery crash that happened on the Brent Spence Bridge earlier this week. Just a really shocking scene. What can you tell us about what the inspectors are doing on that bridge right now?
Well, they are checking for structural integrity. They're doing concrete core sampling. They're doing steel sampling. They'll have a metallurgist looking at the metal. They want to know if that concrete deck is, safe to be driving on. They need to know if the steel trusses are all safe. I don't know if they have today. We haven't had an update today, but as of yesterday, they were doing climbing on it. They were not allowing heavy equipment onto the bridge, such as snooper trucks, which I got to ride in one once. It's kind of like a cherry picker that lets you go out on a big arm and go up under the bridge or go up into the rafters and things. They weren't allowing that on just yet.
You can see the bridge today. I happened to check it out today. You can see just how charred parts of it is, which, you know, to an untrained eye like mine, it looks pretty scary. What do we know as far as a timeline for these inspectors? We heard different estimates from both states.
Yeah, as of yesterday's news conference with Secretary of Transportation Jim Gray and Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, they wouldn't really put a timeline on it other than to say several weeks, possibly more than a month to get it on, to get it back open. They do think, at least they were saying yesterday, that it would be able to be reopened, they said, And I forget where I was going.
Oh, that's okay. No, that's
did
all
I
right.
Answer the question?
You did, and I'll just help you out here because Governor Beshear in Kentucky and Secretary Jim Gray, the Transportation Cabinet Secretary in Kentucky, who is working out of Northern Kentucky right now, they did put a bit of a timeline on this. They said it could be. We are thinking of weeks more than we are days, and Governor Beshear was a little more optimistic than Governor Mike DeWine on the Ohio side, apparently, because Governor Beshear said this would be about maybe a month that we're looking at least a month. And, what I am seeing reported now is that Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is saying 60 to 90 days. But we haven't heard anything new to that respect today, Tana.
I haven't seen anything new today from the governor's office, but you're right. Jim Gray yesterday said several weeks, possibly more than a month.
And this,
they are saying, I knew what I was going to say also on top of that, is that they are, according to Jim Gray, sort of working on the inspection and the repair process in parallel, he said, meaning that while they're still doing the inspections, they're already starting to line up suppliers and contractors that would do whatever repairs are deemed necessary by the inspection crews. And they've got four engineering consulting firms, as well as a material specialist, and the Ohio inspectors and the Kentucky inspectors are involved in that process.
And at this point, they have no idea how much this is going to cost. And it's just a very significant development.
Right. No, I asked that question yesterday and they said too early for that. They also said, at least as of yesterday, a cause of the crash remains. The investigators are still working on that as well.
And we're going to talk about that crash coming up. And I want to note that I submitted a question that they did not answer. They referred to previous statements. What's the worst case scenario, right? Like when you're inspecting this, let's say it comes back and it's determined that this bridge, it's unsalvageable, you know.
Yeah.
So we're waiting for any type of information about that. But let's go back a few days to when this whole thing started. What happened on the bridge?
Well, you know, that might be a better question for you to sort of explain. About 2:45 on, would that be Wednesday morning? Then two semis, one somehow jackknifed. We're not entirely sure how, hitting another one. And the secondary one, which to my understanding is basically what we would call lye. It gets used in making things like soap. And while it's not necessarily a like super hazardous substance, I guess, it does burn at extremely high temperatures. So The diesel fuel from the trucks spilled out onto the bridge, some 400 gallons at least, you know, initially caught fire. They're not really entirely sure how much ended up burning, but then the potassium hydroxide got involved in the process, and that's what took it to, you know, temperatures of 1500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is why it burned so hot and so intense and made the process of even getting on to the bridge to inspect it so much further along, because they had to wait for it to cool down in order for people to get on the bridge to check it out.
That's why I'm encouraging people to go to WVXU.org to see the photo of the aftermath. It's a photo that was provided by the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet, where you can see the charred remains of the trucks that were involved in this thing. It's really a miracle that no one was injured. We should emphasize that. No one was hurt.
Right.
But this fire was so hot that it was burning metal and concrete, and so hot that inspectors couldn't even really begin their work until the next day. We know that with the inspection process of the bridge right now, Tana, that there was concern about river traffic below, and that was shut down.
Yes. So river traffic was shut down for a while by the U.S. Coast Guard. They put a boom in place to catch any debris that might be falling. And also, you know, just unsure about the structural integrity of the bridge after the fire. That was reopened yesterday. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear announced it in his news conference, although then the Coast Guard followed up with me that he may have been a little premature in saying that at his press conference, but it was opened by yesterday afternoon. And while the river doesn't have as much commercial goods being transported on it as, you know, air traffic or road freight, it does have something like 38 million tons worth of, or $38 million. What am I saying here? A lot of stuff gets transported on the river. So if that shipping channel had been shut down, it could have really impacted things, especially because, you know, you can't, there's not like a 275 river version, right? You can't go
That's
around.
A good point. Yeah, there's not an outer loop that you can get around if you're a barge. So that's a very good point. And yes, I mean, a huge part of our economy is on the bridge and underneath the bridge. So a big impact. Yeah. It was very quiet along the river. In the meantime, though, for drivers, there are alternate routes. And I have to say, you know, I live in downtown Covington, and lately in the evenings, it's been really crowded at the restaurants and the bars. And I know we're all hyper-conscious of crowds because of the COVID situation that's going on. I noticed last night, Thursday night, that there were hardly no people. There were really no one around. And I'm seeing an impact already that this traffic disruption has brought in terms of people coming into the community. If people, however, are trying to get to work, for example, where are officials sending the drivers as alternate routes?
You know, I think the bulk of the traffic is being detoured to 275 and to 471. You can also detour into some of the other bridges that go across the Roebling. At last check was still closed. However, you know, officials in Covington are still saying they anticipate it will open by rush hour today. Everything I have on that is about an hour old, so my apologies if it has opened in the last hour. But
well, we should note that it's shut down because the commercial trucks.
Yes, some trucks sort of diverted and thought, well, okay, we'll take the Roebling, which has something like an 11-ton weight limit on it. And so Covington police just had to shut it down because too many people were illegally going across it. I mean, it says not to take trucks across it.
And so that means there's two bridges connecting Covington to Cincinnati that are out of order right now. I came across the Clay Wade Bailey Bridge today to come to the station to do this show. So we do have some. The Taylor Southgate Bridge is open in Newport, and so is the I-471, the Daniel Carter Beard Bridge, also colloquially known as the Big Mac Bridge, that is available. This is obviously a developing story, as we like to say in the business, Tana, so we're going to continue to keep an eye on it. You just said, you know, we're keeping an eye specifically on the Roebling Bridge right now, because the chances of that bridge opening sooner than the Brent Spence are pretty high.
And I just need to make one sort of like nitpicky correction to something that was said, because it's been made super clear to me. When we say 3% of the nation's gross domestic product crosses that bridge each year, it's the components that go into it. So we really need to say the equivalent of 3% of the nation's GDP. Because GDP is finished goods.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because I know you got some pushback on that. This story was picked up by NPR, and so there was some pushback, which one, shows how smart our listeners are, and two, how much smarter you've just made me. So thank you for doing that, Tana. Before we let you run, and again, continue to follow this story, WVXU.org. Do take a moment to take a look at these photos if you haven't seen them yet. It's really jarring what happened on this bridge. It was a very serious accident, and there was some very serious damage to this bridge, so check it out. But before we let you run, Tana, I know that you did cover some general news this week that you typically do, the Hamilton County Commission. I understand that the budget that they're working on is being described as a good news budget in a difficult time. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Right. So they were sort of anticipating at the beginning of the year, beginning of the pandemic, that, you know, everything was just going to go to pot because they were, having lots of losses and all sorts of things. People had to get furloughed and they were sort of projecting big gaps. However, the county administrator, Jeff Aluto, said this week that he has a $290.7 million proposed budget that is structurally balanced. And I should say, this is all because the commission voted last year to keep what was known as the Union Terminal Restoration Tax, a quarter cent sales tax. They decided to keep that on the books and then, you know, put those collections, which began in April, to go to the county, onto, you know, the county books. And that's what's able to make the budget, you know, optimistic, if you will. Aluto, again, he's the county administrator, suggests that if without that tax, the county would be looking at a $36 to $40 million gap.
And is any of this contingent on, the COVID situation getting worse?
Well, yeah, I mean, if it gets a lot worse and everything gets shut down, then, you know, the sales tax revenues could potentially start to plummet. They're doing okay right now. So, yeah, if everything gets shut down again and if employers have to lay off people or furlough people, yeah, it could. It's not all rosy, is what he said. There are some, you know, places where it could go awry. There is risk if the pandemic negatively affects the economy.
Public hearing scheduled on the proposed budget recommended for Thursday, December 3rd and Thursday, December 10th. According to Tana's reporting, those times are yet to be determined, but one is expected to be in the evening and one at 1:30. We do expect a vote possibly on December 17. Read more of this story at WVXU.org. We did get some good news this week. If you're a Reds fan, Tana, and then we're leaving you alone. I know you're not the sports reporter around here. You're the animal reporter primarily, right?
But we did animals and soccer.
We did get some good news about an athlete, even though it's been another sort of challenging sports year for us.
Right. So, you know, you sort of started the week by FC Cincinnati finishing at the bottom of the Eastern Division of Major League Soccer, not qualifying for the playoffs. However, Reds pitcher Trevor Bauer is the 2020 National League Cy Young Award winner. And so that's, you know, a nice little feather in the cap, a nice little thing for Reds. And I think the kind of coolest thing here is that Bauer is the first ever Red.
Unbelievable.
To earn a Cy Young.
You think about the long history of the Cincinnati Reds and the pedigree and sort of the great seasons that the franchise has had over the centuries. And this is the first Cy Young Award winner. So congrats to Trevor Bauer and congrats to Tana Weingarten. Yeah, big time. Everybody was pretty much in agreement that this 29-year-old pitcher was the best in the league this year. Tana Weingarten, the best in our league. Thank you so much for spending a little bit of Friday with us. We'll look forward to more of your reporting at WVXU.org.
My pleasure.
I want to let you know that Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley announced just today, Friday, that City Hall will be closing for several weeks to allow for air purifiers and separators to be installed. This was announced during his Greater Cincinnati Critical COVID-19 update, and that's according to our reporter, Corey Sharber, who was attending that meeting virtually. So City Hall in Cincinnati closing for several weeks to allow for air purifiers and separators to be installed. And we're going to talk a little bit more about City Hall right now. Another major story from this week, the arrest of a second Cincinnati City Council member this year on federal bribery charges. Let's talk about Jeff Pastor's legal case. We're joined by Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge on the phone. Sherry, thank you so much for joining us yet again. We do appreciate it. Do we have Sherry Coolidge?
Yes, hi.
Hi, so glad that you could be with us again. I understand that since last time we talked, you joined us a couple days ago on this program. The councilman, Jeff Pastor, has, as they say, lawyered up, and Ben Dusing, a prominent Northern Kentucky-based attorney, was speaking to the media not that long ago. Did we learn anything?
You know what? I heard that, I was not there. Sorry. But I'm following along, even though I'm reporting on a couple other things here. But But he did say, you know, it's bigger than Jeff Pastor. I mean, I think that's going to be a big takeaway, and it's the question a lot of people are asking, like if Tamaya did this and if Jeff did this. It is, like, really kind of taking people in that direction. Of course, I will say he was very cryptic and didn't give us any details.
So I appreciate that you weren't there and that you're kind of following along as we all are. This happened just about, I don't know, it was scheduled for 11:30 on Friday morning. But, I mean, is that to suggest, is he making the suggestion that there's more people doing potentially illegal things?
That, I mean, I'm following along, and that is, you know, that's the only thing that really, you know, you could take away from that. Of course, you know, he is defending his client. You know, I don't want to say that. You should look at everything through a prism of, you know, why people would say certain things. And, you know, we are hearing, too, that both, you know, Ben Dusing, Jeff's attorney, and the attorney for his associate are like, we are going to vigorously fight these charges. So these attorneys, I think, are going to be very much out there with claims, you know, of that they feel like more exonerate their clients.
Well, let's set this up for those who may not be as familiar or just loosely familiar, just so that we remind everybody what these charges are and what they're related to. The councilman was arrested this week on federal bribery charges, Sherry. What are they allegedly related to?
You know, this was a pay-to-play scheme that they're alleging, and that Jeff Pastor sold his votes and, like, you know, favorable action with inside City Hall, trip to Florida. These are things that are all outlined in a 20-page indictment in which there were undercover FBI agents recording what was going on. And they detail this trip to Florida in September of 2018 over a long weekend on a private chartered jet. And then it talks about exchanging bags of cash. We are talking about $55,000, $45,000 of it exchanged hands in cash. And, you know, with very explicit things recorded, these attorneys, of course, are saying, you know, there's some explanations for some of these things. We don't know what that is. But just these recorded things that, like, you know, I'm going to need a salary for myself and my associate. One line that is quoted in this indictment is, basically the medium income of somebody who's going to do something like this is $200,000. Just want to let you know that. And so it's just this detailed, you know, selling of a vote.
And as we spoke earlier this week, Sherry, on this program, the similarities, though apparently unrelated to the case of former Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, who was arrested on similar charges. I mean, they're right down to trips to Florida and exchanging money for votes. Tell us a little bit
the
about...
The biggest difference...
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I was going to say, the biggest difference between these two is that Jeff Pastor is, one of his indictment charges of 10 is conspiracy. And the things that lay out this conspiracy charge, as opposed to Tamaya, is accused, of course, of very serious things. The selling of her vote, this bribery of taking cash, and then she went on a trip. She didn't take the trip as part of the actual bribery, which is alleged in Jeff Pastor's indictment. However, the conspiracy really touches on the fact that this is, like, really well thought out. Sean Tamaya's case seemed more out of desperation. I need cash. Help me, help me. In the recordings that are quoted in that indictment. In this case, there was actually a 501c3 set up to, quote, sanitize the money and, like, asking of these salaries. And so he is accused of conspiracy along with these other charges. It makes it a more serious thing.
We're talking with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sherry Coolidge, who joins us on the phone. We're talking about the arrest this week on federal bribery charges of Cincinnati City Councilman Jeff Pastor. Sherry, can't help but notice there was a city council meeting on Thursday, and Councilman Pastor was not there?
He was not. There were rumors that he was going to be there. Of course, Tamaya never came back to council after her indictment was handed down. It took her a little bit of time. She did resign because there was such, you know, a cry for her to do so, and she did do that. It is playing out in a similar way. There's no suggestion at this moment that Jeff Pastor is going to resign. He does not need to resign, under any sort of laws with the charter or anything. You don't have to go to meetings. You can just keep skipping them, getting paid. But there's these outside mechanisms that, you know, people can take. Ask a probate court to decide, you know, through a court process that he's not fit to serve. Ask, you know, the state to suspend him. Neither one of those processes has really started, but I mean, there's definitely like bubbling up, like people are talking about that.
And as far as what people are saying, it seems that most members of council who have expressed any opinion on this suggest that Councilman Pastor should step down.
You know, they really did. They were a little bit slower with Tamaya. I think because everybody was so stunned, and you didn't even really want to think that. You know that there's been time to digest that and that it actually happened and what it means. You know, that you have to wonder about the deals. I mean, they voted yesterday on development deals in City Hall, and had Jeff been there, he'd be voting on them. I mean, you never really can tell what's going on. And, I mean, I've been going back and thinking about other deals, of course, because a lot of these allegations date to 2018. And for a variety of reasons, not to mess up other cases and timelines related to the election where you really can't do a lot of things in the federal system, it has taken a while to come to fruition. And you have to wonder in this in-between time, what happened? I mean, there was supposed to be a special planning commission meeting today talking about these urban overlay districts that on their face are, you know, if you look at like all of the research on them, are very good, you know, city planning. But Jeff Pastor brought those forward. And so, I mean, that meeting was canceled today.
I can imagine. I heard Mayor John Cranley reference Murray Seasongood. And our listeners probably hear the name Murray Seasongood than the average Cincinnatian does because of the foundation that is a supporter of this program and this station. But Murray Seasongood, of course, was a person who led government reform in Cincinnati. He was mayor from 1926 to 1930 and founded the Charter Party that we all know. And I believe that John Cranley said specifically that Murray Seasongood would be turning over in his grave if he knew the type of corruption that was going on in City Hall right now because of the reflection that it cast on the mayor and other members of council and the staff that work at the city building.
I mean, that's 100% true. This is 2 in 1 year. And then you have one of their attorneys saying this is much bigger than that. I mean, that is what John Cranley, I do think, was talking about. And when you talk about Murray Seasongood, this charter system is held up as an example of the best government, how our government is run. And you have to look at it at this point and say, if it's the best government and that's what it's supposed to be, how did this happen? Like, because this is the worst example of government and the worst that could happen in a government system when it's always supposed to be the best.
I want to talk a little bit about one of the characters in this story, and that is U.S. Attorney David DeVillers. You and your colleague at the Inquirer, Jason Williams, and we also enjoy having on this program when we can, profiled the role that he's playing in here, cracking down on public corruption. What can you tell our listeners about David DeVillers?
You know, I've gotten to know him a lot over the last couple of weeks, and I have to say, I am so impressed. You know, the U.S. attorneys for the Southern District, they are chosen by the president, okay? But it's a process that the senator of, you know, whoever the president is.
That's why we're thrilled we found this place in Taylor Park.
Hang on just a moment. Did we lose Sherry? Sounds like it switched over to some sound.
I mean,
do we still have Sherry Coolidge with us? Okay. Why don't we do this? We will take our break now, and if we reconnect with Sherry, we'll follow up with her and finish up our conversation. We were just about at the end of the conversation, but if she's still around on the phone, we'll bring her back on the air to finish the conversation about David DeVillers. I think it's a very interesting profile that she wrote with Jason Williams, so we're going to bring that to you. Also, a little later on, we will be talking about a local woman who says her lease at her apartment wasn't renewed after a landlord removed her Black Lives Matter sign. And then after that, Jeopardy host Alex Trebek, who died this week at the age of 80, he spent a summer here in Cincinnati. We're going to talk about his memories from here. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We did go ahead and say goodbye to Sherry Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer after some sort of technical difficulty as that segment was concluding. I do recommend that you read more of Sherry's reporting at the Cincinnati Inquirer. She's great and was kind enough to offer some time to us on two different shows this week. So, Sherry, if you're still listening to us, thank you for being on, and I apologize for whatever happened. We're going to find out what went wrong and on whose end it did. If you all didn't know, it is Friday the 13th, and you know it now for sure. So we'll continue on with our weekly news review now. A woman and her son here in our area are forced to move after living in the same apartment for 4 years. The woman says her lease wasn't renewed shortly after her landlord removed her Black Lives Matter sign. We have WCPO reporter Lucy May joining us by Zoom now. Lucy, welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much, Michael.
I'm glad you could be with us. This is quite a story. What can you tell us about this local mother and where she lives and just how jarring of a situation this is for her?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Raina Moore and her son Chase had lived in this. It's the first level of a duplex in Kennedy Heights for nearly 4 years. She moved into this place when her son was an infant. She very carefully sought out the neighborhood because she wanted to be in a community where her son could attend Pleasant Ridge Montessori School. Keep in mind, he was a little bitty baby, but she was doing her homework. She loved the street. She visited for, you know, different times of day, different days of the week to make sure it was a place that felt welcoming, where kids could play safely outside. And she developed some strong friendships with neighbors there over the 4 years. So when the neighborhood decided to get together and try to buy some Black Lives Matter signs in bulk, she was immediately interested in doing that. So she was in the neighborhood group that bought these Black Lives Matter signs. She rents the place where she lives, and she put it in some mulch outside of the bay window that is part of her living unit. And she did do that while her landlords were out of town. The landlords, the people who own the building, live in the second story unit in this duplex. So she did it while they were out of town. But when they came back a few days later, she says that, you know, they conversed nearly every day, either texting or seeing each other or, you know, in different ways communicated. But about 7.5 weeks after she had placed the sign, she came home one day with her son and the sign was gone. She found out later that the landlords later told her that they had it removed, and that while they supported the Black Lives Matter movement, they thought that media reports had made the matter kind of divisive, and they decided there should be no signs displayed on the property. And I should note that her lease does make mention of not affixing signs to the property. She interpreted that as meaning a more permanent sign, not something that she stuck in the yard, but the landlord said, hey, this was a violation of the lease. You should have talked to us before you put it up, and you know, we're not going to allow it. And then a few weeks after that happened, she got a notice of non-renewal of the lease and had 60 days to move. She now has to leave by the end of this month. She thinks the two things are related. The landlords say, no, they're not. So that's kind of where it stood.
And Lucy, I want to note that Raina Moore, the central figure of this story who placed the Black Lives Matter sign and is not having her lease renewed, she did say to you that she recognizes that these landlords are within their right not to renew her lease. But can you talk a little bit about her overall feelings on the situation?
Yes, she said, you know, definitely they are within their rights not to renew the lease. She understands that. She really felt hurt. Both Raina Moore and the landlords told me that they considered each other friends. They thought they had a friendly relationship. She was hurt that the landlords had the sign removed without talking to her first. The landlords were hurt that she went to the media about it. But she said the whole thing just made her feel, her words were, less than human, which I talked to one of her neighbors too, who lives on the street. Several of the neighbors are upset about the situation because they really love Raina and her son. They're sorry to see them leaving. And, you know, one of the neighbors said that the community was really hurting over this, that they feel like Black Lives Matter is a statement about humanity and not a political statement. And they were sorry to see, you know, the situation unfold the way it did.
One of the neighbors there who talked to you gave a little bit of a history lesson about how in the 1950s, white people were moving into what had been historically Black suburbs. And these are neighbors who are proud of the diversity that is there in Kennedy Heights, where you have black children and white children, and that there are other neighbors who are putting these signs up because I guess there was a Facebook group that organized a bulk purchase.
Right, exactly. Yeah, when we were there interviewing Raina Moore and her neighbors in Kennedy Heights, there were signs, Black Lives Matter signs in yards all up and down the street. It was clear that there was a concerted effort to, you know, communicate that message and embrace that message. There are also signs that are Kennedy Heights specific, celebrating the community's historical diversity and inclusion and integration. And so that we saw some signs in yards celebrating that too. Of course, I did talk to an expert from Cleveland State University who's an expert on tenant-landlord law. And she said, the thing is, you don't have the same rights about putting things in your on the property if you don't own it. You know, your rights are different when you're a renter. So that's certainly is a factor in all this. But it but yeah, the Raina Moore was definitely not alone in having a Black Lives Matter sign placed outside of where she lives.
But now Raina Moore is looking for another place to live, and she had moved into this area with the intention of putting her son into a certain school. So what is her situation now?
She's really struggling a bit. She would love to stay in Kennedy Heights because it has everything that she wanted in the neighborhood for her son. She really has been trying to provide a lot of stability for him. And this has obviously is shaking things up. So she's still desperately trying to look for a new place to rent in Kennedy Heights. The housing market, the way it is, that it's getting real expensive in lots of neighborhoods. One of the neighbors told me that Kennedy Heights is a pretty hot neighborhood right now. So she's struggling a little bit to find a place that will meet her needs, that has a similar rent to the rent that she was paying for this duplex and will keep her in the same neighborhood that she loves so much for herself and her son.
You can read more of Lucy's story at WCPO.com. We are talking with Lucy May, reporter at WCPO. And you did another story this week, Lucy, that I want to talk about. We did happen to do a similar segment on this just this week about the scarcity of shelter beds for people experiencing homelessness in our region. And this is particularly troubling this year because not only do we have the brutal winter coming, we have this pandemic that appears to be getting worse in our region. You profiled this struggle on both sides of the river, in Cincinnati and in northern Kentucky. What's the situation?
The situation is potentially pretty dire. As you said, the cold winter is coming. A lot of shelters have had to reduce their capacity because of the pandemic so they can provide more social distancing. And the Cincinnati and Hamilton County have 35% more people who are homeless and living on the streets in the first 10 months of this year than the city and county did in the first 10 months of 2019. So it's really a recipe for disaster. In northern Kentucky, it's the same situation. A lot of the shelters there have had to reduce capacity. There are some efforts underway to address this on both sides of the river. I know you talked about the Cincinnati and Hamilton County side yesterday, so I won't belabor that. But in northern Kentucky, Kim Webb, the executive director of Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky, told me that Campbell County Judge Executive Steve Pendry actually reached out to her and said, hey, we could provide some space for you in the, and now I have to remember what it's called because I'm terrible about it's the it's in my story, but I have it pulled up. But
have your story pulled up.
Thank
I'm
you,
sorry,
Michael.
I was just scrolling it. But Campbell County Judge, the Restricted Custody Center, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that is it. The Restricted Custody Center, it's one of their detention facilities. It's currently vacant, and it's big enough that the emergency shelter in Northern Kentucky could shelter twice as many people safely in that center as it can currently in its Scott Boulevard location in Covington. So right now, Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky opened up November 1st for its winter shelter operations. The shelter can only have 24 people there safely to shelter this winter because of fire codes and social distancing requirements, but they could have 50 people at the Campbell County facility. There's an interior courtyard, which will make it easier for people to, get outside and take a smoke break or whatever they need to do. And Kim Webb is very, very optimistic that in the next few weeks, this is going to be a terrific alternative for Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky. I also talked to Daniel Amrine at Welcome House of Northern Kentucky, and they're looking to reconfigure a Gardens and Greenup building that they have on Greenup Street in Covington that's currently vacant to try to allow for some extra sheltering to happen there. So Amrine told me that she thinks they could have as many as 30 people staying in that building once they add some showers and do some basic kind of carpentry work they need to get that building into shape.
You can read more of Lucy May's reporting at WCPO.com. I anticipate that we'll have more to say on that subject matter as the winter approaches and as the pandemic continues to rage. And Lucy, I know you'll come back on when we need you. So I hope that you will.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Indeed. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
We lost Alex Trebek, longtime host of Jeopardy. And you may not know this, but he spent a summer in Cincinnati. And we're also going to discuss that and a national radio program that was produced here in town, canceled. That's next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We finish up our weekly news review now with WVXU media beat writer John Kieswetter. He's on the phone with us. Hey, Kies.
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for taking some time. Listen, you know, when you're in the news business in Cincinnati long enough, you get to be familiar with the fact that whatever's happening in the world, there's some random local connection to it. But I had no idea that Alex Trebek had such an intimate connection to Cincinnati. He spent a summer here, and you talked to him about it.
Actually, a couple of times. It was probably back in the late 80s, early 90s, early on in my TV beat career, that I saw a little blurb in a magazine where Alex Trebek was saying that he was a Cincinnati garbage man. That put up my antenna, and I finally was able to meet him and actually talk to him several times. But in the summer of 1958, after his freshman year in college in Ottawa, his mom was working in Cincinnati. She came here as a governess for the Cantor family, Joseph and Nancy Cantor, a developer. And she was talking to the Cantor family, and they said, well, we've got some job openings. Why don't you have him come down and work this summer? So he spent the summer as a maintenance man and kind of a jack of all trades at a Avondale apartment complex. One of his jobs was picking up and taking out the trash. So he would jokingly tell people that he was a garbage man in Cincinnati.
That is a colorful way to put it. He's a colorful figure, certainly a pop culture icon. He died Sunday after a battle with pancreatic cancer, but he worked right up until the end. There are episodes of Jeopardy that are going to air through most of December, it looks like. But let's talk a little bit more about Alex Trebek and Cincinnati. I mean, talk a little bit more about what he did while he was here. He actually had a big crush on Jane Morgan, a performer at the Beverly Hills Supper Club. It's crazy to think about that.
Yeah, one of the things he remembered most, he remembered about Ted Kaluski in his sleeveless uniform at Crosley Field, but also he went to the Beverly Hills Supper Club, and he was 18 at the time, and he saw this singer, Jane Morgan. She had been on Broadway with Can Can and Kiss Me Kate and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and it was kind of his first taste of show business, and says, she was gorgeous. I just fell in love. She was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. And another woman made an impression on a girl about his age, and he didn't mention her name, but said she had a 58 Chevy Impala convertible. It was red, and we spent the summer dating and hanging out with her all summer. So that was part of his pleasant memories in town here, too.
I love this quote that you include from your reporting, because he's not wrong when he talks about weather in the summer in Cincinnati. He says, I'd go back to my apartment because they let me have an apartment in the complex, and I had no furniture except a bed and a television set. My dresser was a cardboard box that the toilet paper came in, and I'd go there for lunch and drink about a gallon of lemonade because I was so thirsty. Cincinnati, as you know, in the summer, he said, you get 95 degrees and 99% humidity, but it's a lovely city. So we did have a good time here, I suppose.
When Jeopardy changed from Channel 9 to Channel 19 back in 2012, and he did press. And I really wanted to interview him, and when I talked to him, he really wanted to talk to the newspaper in Cincinnati because he said he had all these fond memories. He said, I always had a warm spot in my heart for Cincinnati. I don't mind telling anybody and everybody. But he liked living here. He loved the city. He had very fond memories. And then there was another way that Cincinnati crossed paths. I was talking to him one time, and because I had interviewed Pete Rose's wife after the Pete and Carol Rose at the time, his wife, had moved to L.A. and Studio City, and she had mentioned, well, you know, Alex Trebek is my landlord. So I asked him about it, and he said yes, that he lived in Studio City, and the house next door had a tennis court, and Alex was really into tennis. So he bought the house next door and rented it out, and one of the tenants was Pete and Carol Rose. And when they had problem with the plumbing or the electric or something, they called their landlord. And who would show up but Alex Trebek?
Wow. That's amazing. And that's why we keep John Keysweater around, man. He's always got great scoops and stories like this. And we are talking with John Keysweater. He's our media beat writer here at WVXU. You can always read more of his coverage at WVXU.org. There's some news being made at another station down the dial, WLW 700. They canceled America's Truckin' Network. Now, I don't imagine that we have a lot of audience overlap, but this is a significant media story because this is a show that airs overnight, midnight to 5 a.m., America's Truckin' Network, and perhaps people are more familiar with the term the Truckin' Bozo, right?
Well, the Truckin' Bozo started this show back in 1984. It was shortly after Randy Michaels took over WLW and really kind of revived it and brought it to the back to number one status, because at that point it was like number five or six in the city. And shortly after the Bozo took over, effectively everybody called him the Bozo, he actually made national news in People magazine. He was doing his show, taking callers from all over, and a woman called him from a truck stop in Georgia, and her demeanor changed, and he could hear something going on in the background, and he figured out that this woman was being robbed at the time she was on the air in Cincinnati. So he kept her on the air as much as he could, but he also called police in Georgia, and with his description, they eventually arrested somebody. So that was kind of his first claim to fame. But you know, the Truckin' Show, WLW Bosa, they reach 38 states at night, and I know I've listened to it in New Jersey and New York and in far away as Florida. So it had an audience. It ran 36 years. Dale was eventually succeeded by his son, Steve Summers, who did the show until last Sunday night. Friday. It would have been Friday a week ago today. And then later on Friday morning a week ago, he posted on Facebook that he had been let go. And then they let go the guy who did the overnight, the weekend show. Dave Martin did a show called Riding the Wave with Dave. And so then on Sunday, it was clear that somebody else, a guest host, had taken over the time slot, and that the America's Trucking Network hit the end of the road after 36 years.
Yeah, that's quite a long run. And right now, veteran local broadcaster Dan Carroll is, I guess, getting a trial run of some sort, carrying that overnight. So you can still expect a certain type of, shall we say, right-wing politics in the wee hours of the evening.
Yes. Yeah, I've been listening on and off this week. And yes, there's still strong support for President Trump and strong, denial suspect that there's a president-elect that might be named Biden. So, that filled the airways for much of the this week.
I worked with Dan Carroll at another station here in town, a television station, and we know each other well. I follow him on Twitter, and he has certainly been tweeting about covering the election fraud, as he puts it. So when he's talking on this overnight show, I think he hopes to get an overnight gig. People probably remember him as an anchor and reporter on Channel 19 and then as the traffic reporter at Channel 9. But I think his heart's always been in being a sort of right-wing political radio host. So,
well, after I think he was in the Air Force. He was in the service, and he was in a couple of smaller stations, Greensburg, Indiana. And when he came to WLW, he was actually the news anchor overnight for the Truckin' Bozo, and so his start at WLW, I'm pretty sure, was was on the overnight show with Steve Summers' dad.
And that was my start too, Keese, doing the overnight news on Sunday nights at 700 WLW in between truck and call.
Look how far you've come.
I'm much more comfortable on the FM side of the dial talking to you now, Keese, than I am. But we'll keep an eye out for what happens with that developing story. Obviously, that is a station that has a long history in our community, and whatever they decide to do could have an impact on the way people feel about things. So we'll keep an eye on that. I do want to talk about a film. I mean, Cincinnati has become sort of a Hollywood of the Midwest until the pandemic came and shut a lot of productions down. But another movie that was shot here called A Lion in the House is premiering on Netflix. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it was filmed, and it took the filmmakers 9 years to do it. The filmmakers are Stephen Bogner and Julia Reichert from Yellow Springs. We know them from the film American Factory, which won both an Emmy and an Academy Award earlier this year for the GM plant that was converted to a Chinese-owned glass plant up in Moraine and in Dayton.
Yes, we featured them on this show when we talked about American Factory, yes.
So they're one of their first projects, and definitely their biggest projects, they spent 9 years filming and editing, talking to five kids and their families, five kids who had cancer and were getting treatment at Cincinnati Children's Medical Center, and their doctors and their nurses. And it aired originally on PBS in 2006 as two parts, 2 hours each, and actually won an Emmy Award. And as part of their deal with Netflix, Netflix has picked it up this past Tuesday, the 10th, and it's now available on Netflix called A Lion in the House.
And so this is a throwback. I mean, the movie itself, it's about 15 years old at this point.
Correct. But it's after it aired on PBS, then Stephen told me that it's been used as a training film for nurses and doctors, because it's not the easiest thing to watch, because it's about kids suffering with cancer and their parents and their caregivers, and kind of the roller coaster, the ups and downs, the good news and bad news, and good news and bad news, and going home and then going back in. But it's a wonderfully intimate film about how these kids and families are struggling with cancer.
And these are very talented filmmakers, obviously, now that they've won an Academy Award. And their next project, which they had talked to us about here, is called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. And that's about women and the workplace and the history of that. And we'll be looking forward to that. I know you are, too. John Keesewetter is the media beat writer at WVXU. Read his handiwork at WVXU.org. He's always got great stories for you to read. John, thank you so much for taking part of your Friday out with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good weekend to you and all the listeners.
All right. Well, listeners, we have made it to Friday, although it is Friday the 13th. I don't know if you're superstitious. If you are, be extra careful out there, but do enjoy your weekend and be safe. We do appreciate the time that you spent with us all week long. You have been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical directors today are Rick Andress and Josh Elstrow. And you can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. Every single episode ever at your fingertips, WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We're going to talk again on Monday. See you then.